From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Joan Trumpower Mulholland's mugshot is kind of famous. She's a white woman who had signed on to the civil rights movement in the 1960s. She was one of the Freedom Riders, and she was arrested in Jackson, Mississippi. Her mugshot has become an icon from that era, not just because she was a white woman fighting for the rights of black people, but because she was a Southern white woman, and there's something about that photo that conveys a kind of serenity. Joan herself has said she looked more calm in that photo because she felt at home in the South. She was, as she put it, within her own culture, not in hostile territory. Today in the program, Joan Trumpower Mulholland is joining us to talk about her story as a woman from the South who fought to end the Southern way of life. Join us after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Joan Trumpower Mulholland grew up in the Jim Crow South. Her great-grandparents owned slaves in Georgia. Her parents were fierce segregationists. And the way she describes the people who wanted to keep the races separate in those days was that they were the product of their environment. But Trumpower Mulholland was also a product of that environment. And for whatever reason, she came to a different conclusion about civil rights. She fought for it. She once said, "Everyone has to pick their target, and hers was the Southern way of life." So she took part in dozens of sit-ins and marches and actions. She was dragged from a lunch counter at a Woolworth's drugstore in Jackson, Mississippi. She was one of the original Freedom Riders in 1961. She was arrested for taking part, in fact, and her mugshot has become one of the icons of that era. Joan Trumpower Mulholland is in Utah this week, so we're taking the opportunity to talk to her about her remarkable life. She's joining us here in the studio, and welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I should mention she has a number of speaking engagements here, and we'll give you some details about that a little bit later on the program. One of the things that your son has created a documentary about your story, and one of the things that I found really interesting about it is that for years, for whatever reason, although he has a reason in the film, and I won't give that away, you kept some of these stories, or you kept a lot of these stories to yourself. Why was that?
That's not exactly true. That's the way he tells it. Okay. Now, when friends from the civil rights movement would visit, particularly on holiday times and all, with their kids.
You had plenty to talk about.
We were like a couple of World War II veterans parsing out all the details. Those kids just wanted to escape and go play. They heard it all.
Right, okay. So you weren't keeping any of this to yourself. You were happy to talk about it.
Sure.
Yeah.
But try and tell a kid something he doesn't want to hear.
Good.
Or even she doesn't want to hear.
Your great-grandparents, as I mentioned, were slave owners in Georgia. You were raised in Arlington, Virginia. After the war, this is interesting, though. After the Civil War, your great-grandparents were brought down, seems like quite low. I mean, became sharecroppers.
Yeah, it was all gone. You know, Sherman marched.
Yeah. So how did that affect their sense of things, being broken and humiliated?
Well, now, this is just my mother's side of the family.
Yeah.
But basically, I think they never got over the war. I didn't hear too much, you know, carrying on about, well, the N-words. But they certainly believed that people should be separate, and there was a— blacks were inferior, because black was a rude term back then. Colored folks was the polite term. But the law, the church, and society all supported segregation,
yeah.
And so that's what they were a product of.
Did you, when you were young, really young, Did you get a sense of race at the time, or was, I mean, did you have, were you conscious of the way, as you just said, you didn't hear people talking that much about black people, but I don't know, what was your sense of race at the time?
You didn't really see black folks around except, you know, doing menial work. I remember when we would drive, and this was when I was probably by the time I was 10 or 12, if we were in the car going near the black neighborhood in Arlington, my mother would reach back and make sure the car doors were locked, back when you had to reach back. Right. And we were told not to look at them. At the, you know, when we were stopped side by side at the stoplight. But I was pretty much oblivious to how separate things were, just because they were so separate you didn't see them.
Yeah.
You only saw white folks.
Did you have a sense that your parents, your mother, who grew up in rural Georgia, I'll use this word, hated black people? Did you get that sense?
I don't know that I would say hated, but certainly looked down on. Now, my daddy was from southwest Iowa, and that was a whole other story.
Yeah.
But down home, because nobody was from Arlington back then, down home was rural Georgia.
There's this story you've told about when you were young. You would, your parents would take you to rural Georgia for a couple of weeks every, I guess it was in the summer.
Right. Vacation every summer.
Vacation every summer. And you'd see, I guess, your grandparents and family members and those kinds of things. And there was this experience you had with a young girl, white girl, named, I think Mary was her name.
Mary.
Yeah.
Mary.
Mm-hmm. When you dared each other to go to, well, I'll call it the black part of town. That's not,
that's
well,
not what we called it.
Yeah.
Well, she dared me, and of course you can't turn down a dare when you're 10 years old. So, yeah, we went, rode our bikes down, left them along the road, and walked back into the colored, to be polite, section of town. And people just disappeared from view into their houses, back of their houses. I just figured now they weren't going to know anything about those two little white girls coming through. And it was when I saw the school for the black kids. This is before Brown versus Board.
Yeah.
We were separate and equal. When separate was not equal.
Right.
I saw that school. Never had one room shack that had never had a bit of paint on it. The door was ajar. You could see the pot-bellied stove for heat. No grass. No play equipment, to my memory. No glass in the windows, just wooden shutters, which was not that uncommon in the South. A hand pump in the yard, and to my memory, one outhouse. So I would say now this whole thing about unisex bathrooms ain't nothing new. But it struck me how unfair this was, because out the other end of town was the fanciest building, the pride of the community for miles around, a brick post-World War II schoolhouse. It's still the fanciest building, only now it's an assisted living center. And I just knew this was wrong, because we learned in Sunday school you had to treat other people the way you want to be treated, and, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself and all that. And we were hypocrites with these two separate schools, and I knew I should be honest and follow what I learned in Sunday school and try to help do something about it when I had the chance. That came in 60 with the sit-ins.
Wow, it did indeed. I think I may have identified, at least this is my sense of it, kind of an important theme in your life. And I want to know what you think about this. It's how closely connected you feel to Southern culture, to the sense of community. But also how, and this is interesting, when you talk, when I've heard you talk about this, your experiences, is how being proud of being part of the South.
Of course I'm proud of being a Southerner.
Right. So that seemed to distinguish you from some of the other white people involved in the Civil Rights Movement.
They were Yankees.
Yankees. Right, right.
Mostly.
Mostly, yeah. Did you talk about that? Because it seems, it's interesting how the Northern whites often look down at Southerners.
That was a problem.
Yeah.
Particularly in jail when you were locked up in the same cell with those, you know, white Yankees who looked down on Southerners. I mean, I ended up in the Hinds County Jail in Mississippi having more in common with the black Southern students from the sit-in movement. And I understood them much more than I understood my own cellmates who didn't even know what grits were, much less, you know, collard greens and black-eyed peas and things. And they didn't sing right. They didn't sing like they were in church. They sang like they were on a Union picket line. I find my Southern accent just coming on as we speak.
Yes, indeed. And does it when you reflect back?
Yes, and when I'm talking with other Southerners.
Yeah, for sure.
I remember once in Mississippi when I was a student down at Tougaloo College, there were these Jewish lawyers from New York who were coming down to help us, and we were glad to see them. But they were trying to talk to some of the rural black folks, and they literally could not understand each other. But I could repeat just about verbatim what one of them said, and then the other one could understand me, and back and forth. Well, not translating, just repeating. I had a compatible accent.
That must have been an advantage, to be able to be a translator, to be able to explain to these Northern, who were, of course, greatly well-intentioned, who came down. You don't question that, of course.
I don't question that, no.
But that must have been a real advantage and something original and distinct for a white girl from the South, proud of it.
Of course I'm proud of it.
Yeah.
But it was also an advantage that I understood where the jailers were coming from. They were trying to intimidate us by putting us up in parchment and all and making a point that you're far away from everything. But I was one of them. I was, you know, from the culture. I understood the game. And so I was not near as frightened. I think that's why my mugshot, I look pretty peaceful, where most of the freedom riders in their mugshots, they look, at least the white ones, look scared out of their mind because they were in enemy territory. They were prisoners of war.
Yeah. I wonder, one of the things I've seen your activism described in the documentary, it's described as a spiritual mission. Is that right?
Well, I think I was drawn to it because of my understanding of Christianity. And at that point, I was a regular churchgoer and, you know, got all those awards for being in Sunday school every Sunday all year. Yeah.
Daddy was a Presbyterian, I guess.
Daddy was a Presbyterian because of the prejudice back in his hometown in Iowa. His family was of Danish ancestry. The town was Swedish. The grocery store was the Swedish grocery store. The Lutheran church, which would have been the obvious thing for a Dane, it was in Swedish. So if you weren't Swedish, the de facto fallback was Presbyterian. That's how we got to be Presbyterians.
Isn't that interesting? But one of the things you said is that you've described yourself as a literalist, that you more or less took the lessons that you were being taught from the Bible literally.
Aren't we supposed to? That was my understanding, that if it says, love thy neighbor as thyself, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, it means that. It's not just speaking. If you're in the mood or they look like you, you know.
But do you... You've described, I mentioned this in the introduction, that one of the ways you've described the way your mother thought, having grown up in rural Georgia, or people who grew up in the Jim Crow South, as products of their environment.
They were.
How do you explain that? What do you mean by that?
Their whole society, everything around them, taught them that the races should be separate, just like the bluebirds and the redbirds aren't hanging out together, and they taught that white people were superior intelligence and what have you. I mean, our founding fathers up through Abraham Lincoln and President Johnson, who succeeded him, all felt that blacks were intellectually inferior, and probably morally and all that, but they were strong, so let them do the work.
Yeah.
But if you're brought up and that's being hammered into you, most folks believe it.
I wonder, I mentioned that quote I really liked where you said that you have to pick your targets in life. Mm-hmm. Yours was the quote-unquote Southern way of life. That was your target. Was that did you actually come to a conscious moment where you thought, I think I have to become an activist. I think I have to fight this. I think I have to do something about this.
I think it was sort of I knew it had to change, and as a Southerner, I should do my part to help change it. But the word activist, that's a recent word.
Sure.
Didn't have that then. Christian might have been more like it.
Is that right?
Yeah, I didn't know the word activist. And the movement was based in the church because the black church was about the only place that was not under the thumb of the white power structure. Or, of course, they could firebomb it, which happened a fair bit.
Sure.
But the movement groups all met in the church. And the music is all taking the church songs and changing a word or two. But everyone knew the tune.
Sure.
And so, yeah, it was spiritual and a reflection of the church.
There's a story.
And the preachers led it.
Right, right. There's a story that I wanted to ask you about. Your son mentions it in the film, that for a time— You were raised by a black woman.
My mother became ill when I was an infant. And, of course, they hired a black lady to sort of take care of me during the day and all. She didn't live in the house, but she came in, and her name was Dorothy. I never heard her last name that I can recollect. I find that white folks would hire black people to take care of their children and cook their food and this and that, but thought they were diseased and smelly and inferior and all that. I mean, it doesn't make sense.
How do you describe your relationship with that woman? I mean, I'm not sure how long she taught you.
It was just for, I think, maybe 3 months when I was an infant. So I have no memory of her, just a couple of pictures of her holding me.
You wanted to go to a small church school.
Yeah, Muskingum College in Ohio, where John Glenn graduated.
Is that right? But your mother wouldn't have
no.
It. It wasn't fancy enough for her liking.
Oh, no. Yeah. My mother was strong on prestige. Once she got out of that sharecropping thing, she was what we would call today a social climber.
Yeah, yeah.
But she wanted me to go to Duke, a name school. And I figured the fact that it was segregated in the South was a factor in her thinking, too.
Yeah. So you did. Went to Duke.
Well, it got me out of the house.
Yeah. Did you want to get out of the house?
Yes.
Why?
Because my mother was driving me crazy.
Yeah.
Doesn't that happen to a lot of folks when they're teenagers?
It absolutely does.
Because they're driving their mothers crazy. But
that's right. Was part of that her thinking on race, or was that a factor then?
I think, I don't really remember, but I think it was just that, teenage mother conflict thing.
I want to ask you about the first time you participated in a sit-in.
Truthfully, I don't remember the actual sit-in.
Is that right?
But I remember getting into the Durham movement, if we want to go there.
Sure. I am interested in that. Like when you decided, because it seems like, and you've talked about it this way, that there is a point at which you can't really turn back when you take. I think you described it as that first fatal step, and you the only way you can go is forward. So would you just take me through your thinking about that?
Okay. Well, once you as a white Southerner are identified with the black movement, you're pretty much cut yourself loose and are cut loose by your family.
Yeah.
And so you can't say, oh, I'm sorry, and go back in. You've got to go forward with the movement. And the movement becomes like family. Mm-hmm. Now, at Duke University, keep in mind that Durham was the second city after Greensboro, North Carolina, and it was just down the road. Durham was the second city to have sit-ins and picket lines in front of the stores. And one Sunday evening, our chaplain, Presbyterian chaplain, told our youth group on campus that next week some of the students from North Carolina College who are doing the sit-ins and the picketing and all are going to come to our meeting and explain what's about it. And they did, well-dressed, well-spoken, talked in moral and legal terms about the sit-ins. Now, if your money is green at this side of the store, it should be green at the lunch counter. Now, for the younger folks that are listening, think of a cut higher than a dollar store, but not quite up to a Target or a Kmart level. And this is before McDonald's and all these fast food things. So for the same type of quick, cheap food, you went over to the other side of the store where there was what we called a lunch counter. Yeah. And sat down and got your food. I find young folks don't understand this. So if your money is good when you're buying your school supplies and your cheap stuff, it should be just as green at the lunch counter to eat. But it wasn't. And anyway, they explained all this. And then, much to our surprise, at the end, invited us to join them on their demonstrations. At that point, it meant picket line. And a handful of us did, including my roommate who was from New York. And we picketed with them, and then there was time for another sit-in or two. And we joined them, a bunch of us, and Duke University just went ballistic. And I finished out my semester. I wasn't going to lose out on that semester of study. And
but then you dropped out.
And then I dropped out. But I had one professor, I think it was English, and I told him, now we're thinking of a demonstration, and I may miss your class. And if you give one of your infamous pop quizzes, can I make it up? And he smiled and said, oh, no, I'll bring it down to jail because you can't cheat in there. Because he didn't give a pop quiz, but he was very, a lot of the staff and all, in fact, it was the faculty association that kept us from being expelled.
What did your mother think when she heard that you had participated in a sit-in at Duke?
Oh, she was mortified. She just wanted to get me away from all that stuff. I mean, what could she tell her friends and relatives? Oh, my. I think it was, it went against what she believed in, but I think it was her pride and, you know, what could she tell people attitude that was her big thing.
I want to ask you about participating in the Freedom Riders. What sense of the kind of danger did you have about that? Did you know what you were getting into when you were first deciding
to do
this?
Well, now, I was not in the original buses that rolled out of Washington, D.C. So part of our, we were following not just the Bible and nonviolence as preached by Dr. King and turned the other cheek, but we were following Gandhi. And on the Salt March to the Sea, it was if one person was shot or could not continue, somebody else were to step up and take their place. So, of course, we had to step up and take Hank's place. And folks from the Nashville crowd had to step up and take the place. In fact, sit-in students from across the South who had bonded in jail and knew people on the rides stepped up to take their place. And it was the sit-in students who kept the Freedom Rides going. Now, by the time I went, I think it was June 6th I left D.C., it was automatic that you would get to Jackson and you would be arrested. The Kennedys didn't like the Freedom Rides because it was bad for international publicity, da-dee-da. I mean, we made it worse. But they struck a deal with the power structure in Mississippi that there would be no violence like there had been in Alabama. But they could arrest us on a local charge. So we were arrested for breach of peace, for walking in together, which meant that we upset the local folks' peace of mind. So we got arrested for them wanting to take us out. And we did jail no bail, Gandhian style.
Yeah.
So I figured the Freedom Rides, I'd already been accepted at Tougaloo College, north of Jackson, one of the all-black schools. The Freedom Rides gave me a free ticket to Mississippi, and the state of Mississippi gave me free room and board for the summer.
That's right. At the notorious Parchman Prison. penitentiary. Yeah.
Yes, and I have not yet forgiven the new African-American Museum in D.C. They have a prison tower from an Angola prison in Louisiana. They should have gotten one from Parchman.
There's a great story about the prison warden, Fred Jones, writing to your mother, kind of scolding her. How could he raise a girl like this who...
Oh, he was head of the prison.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell that story. I think it's great.
Well, I didn't find out about this till years later, and I think some of his... How could she let a minor child, because I wasn't a minor, you know, rampage around the country, breaking the laws, and with these... I think he used the word Negro, but he could have said something stronger.
You want me to read it to you?
Yeah.
Here it is. He says, "What I cannot understand is why, as a mother, you permitted a minor white girl to gang up with a bunch of Negro bucks and white hoodlums to ramble over this country with the express purpose of violating the laws of certain states and attempting to incite acts of violence."
Well, Mama had nothing to do with it, and she wrote back that if she has understood his feelings as a Southerner, and if she could have stopped me, she certainly would have. And yeah, she would have. Lock, stock, and barrel, probably literally. But
did she ever come to terms with your decision to participate in this?
Not really, but I would say that grandchildren did a lot to sort of mellow our interactions.
Yeah.
But though I had to remind her about her language sometimes. And literally when she was on her deathbed and I was talking to her on the phone, she had been in an assisted living place, had a little heart irregularity, was sent to the hospital to be checked out. They were going to release, said she was fine, no problem. They were going to discharge her the next day. I got arrangements for her to, you know, get picked up by a good family friend and I would be over straight from work. And she just quit being pitiful sounding and just raised her voice. "I'm getting out of here. They got me in a colored room." And I bit my tongue. I didn't ask if it was pink or yellow and just said, "Mom, folks just don't think like that anymore." And that night she died. And I think she just checked out because all her brothers and sisters had died. Her husband was dead. And it was time for her to go, she felt.
That's Joan Trumpauer Mulholland. She's a civil rights activist, took part in dozens of sit-ins during the 1960s. She is in Utah this week. Tomorrow she's going to be at the University of Utah for a free public event. It's a screening of a documentary of her life and activism. It's going to be followed by an onstage conversation with her son, Loki Mulholland. It's tomorrow evening at 6 at the Hayes Christensen Theater at the Marriott Center for Dance. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with civil rights pioneer Joan Trumpauer Mulholland. She is a proud Southerner, white woman who chose to challenge her culture and her family to fight racial discrimination in the South. She's in Utah this week and joining us to talk about her life and her work. I wanted to ask you about going to Tougaloo.
Tougaloo. Not Tupelo. That's Elvis's
Tupelo. That's right. That's right.
Tougaloo.
I want to ask you about Tougaloo College. This is in Jackson. You said that one of the reasons you wanted to apply, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but you had heard the story of Hamilton Holmes and Charlene Hunter Galt, how they were treated when they tried to enroll at the University of Georgia. And that somehow was instrumental in you.
Yes. I think it was a picture of Charlene clutching a Madonna.
Yeah.
And tears streaming on her face. It was appeared in the African-American newspapers. And that just brought to me to the conclusion that this is not integration. Just a couple of two or three black kids at a time going through hell. I mean, there was tear gas and riots and taken off campus and court orders and da-di-da. And if integration was real, it had to be a two-way street. So I thought I should apply to some African-American colleges. And talking about this with some of my fellow activist, the student organization SNCC, they said, well, good idea, but if you're going to do it, you need to go to Mississippi because their students haven't done anything yet and you can help them get going. Well, they got going before I got there. But I was accepted at Tougaloo in spite of the fact that my high school in Virginia refused to send my transcripts. Now that high school is frequently number one in the most culturally diverse high school in the country. But they Tougaloo said they'd accept me on my Duke transcripts.
Yeah, but how were you treated there? Was there any suspicion of the fact that what can this Southern white girl bring to this all-black college?
Well, there was the feeling for some students that I would have an advantage over them academically because I had gone to Duke. There were other students who thought, well, maybe she's just down here to check us out for a semester.
Yeah.
But as one girl put it, still a good friend, when I saw you studying just as hard in the library every night as the rest of us, I figured you were okay. And when I came back, not only the second semester, but the second year, I was in.
They said she's committed. She's one of us.
She's one of us.
Yeah.
And in fact, when they would be visiting ministers and civil rights sorts from the North coming down, the discussion of we are here to do this and you students, and the students thought I was part of their we, and these visitors from the North thought I was part of their we. So I was sort of in a no man's land.
Yeah, yeah.
It was curious, sometimes funny.
Would you talk about May 28th of 1963?
Oh, my.
Set this up for us. Like, this is, because this seemed like a, this was such a, seemed like a, such a crucial moment for you, and there's some terrifying aspects of this story, but get me started. What was the idea?
The idea was there had been a boycott. The NAACP had been trying to do a boycott of downtown businesses that did not treat black customers fairly.
Yeah, this is in Jackson.
In Jackson, Mississippi.
Yes.
On the main street. Back when cities had main streets where all the commercial businesses were.
Right.
And this was a Woolworths. So there was going to be a sit-in at the Woolworths of all Mississippi students from Tougaloo, but students who were citizens of Mississippi, well, citizens is perhaps the wrong word, but native Mississippians.
Sure.
Down the street, there was going to be a diversionary tactic so they could get seated. And we're going to have a picket line. And the assumption was that the sit-ins would be arrested immediately and the picket line would continue. Well, I was what we called a spotter. I was one of the white folks just mingling in the sidewalk crowd and ready to call back to the NAACP's office with the report, or they'd been arrested, they'd been beaten up, whatever. But the picket line was arrested immediately, which we hadn't thought would happen. So the other lady, white lady, and I thought, well, we haven't seen any squad cars going down the street to Woolworth. Let's go see what's happening. Well, about the time we got there, things were going down fast.
Yeah.
Memphis Norman was pulled off his stool and kicked to where he was bleeding in every opening in his head. And then he and his assailant were arrested by an undercover cop. His assailant was a former cop who had been put off the police force for being too violent.
Yeah, Benny Oliver.
Benny Oliver. And so I ended up taking Memphis's seat, or the one that was left vacant. There were two girls that I was sitting between, and we were pulled off. One of them and I were pulled off our stools and almost dragged out of the store, but we weren't going out of the store because there'd be a crowd out there too. And got loose. Actually, they arrested the guy who was dragging me for, you know, assault or something. And I went back on in the store with Annie, and we couldn't get back to Perlina, but we got to the counter at least.
Yeah.
And our big mistake was it was a good time for us to demonstrate. We'd finished our finals. But the high school kids two blocks away, they were in the middle of finals. And the seniors could leave campus and come up to North Capitol Street to get lunch, except they couldn't get lunch because we were there. And also, so we got quite a mob behind us, and big-time segregationists were down near the school telling them to come on up, and the police were encouraging them to come on in the store.
So, and pummel you with sugar and ketchup and mustard.
They wasted all those condiments. Like I wasn't sweet enough. They were pouring all that sugar on my head. And it was such a mob, we couldn't even see the people who were sitting down with Perlina just 12 seats away.
But were you afraid for your life?
Fear doesn't do you any good. It keeps you from knowing what you need to do to stay safe.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to die, but you know, we're going to heaven.
Is that right?
Well, so they tell me. And it's better to die for a cause than to just get run over crossing the street.
You've described being there as kind of an out-of-body experience.
I understand that soldiers have that in combat. Yeah, it was like the real me had left my body and was... my soul, or whatever we want to call it, was sort of hovering up above like a guardian angel, watching the crowd and keeping me informed on what was going on. But what was sitting at the counter was just a shell.
Wow.
The physical body.
Yeah. When did you, how did that moment, that experience affect you? Did it just make you more determined? I mean, did it have an impact? I mean, it just seems like one of a number of these things that you were participating in.
Well, it was probably about the one that turned the most violent, but it was just another sit-in, as far as I was concerned, because now the photo of it is the sit-in photo. And to me, the important thing about that photo is the guy who took it, Fred Blackwell, who still lives in Jackson.
Now, let's describe that photo, because I think that there's you, who you've got, I'm not sure, you've got some sort of crap on your hair that somebody poured on it. And there's Professor John Salter, who's right there. He's got junk poured on his head.
A lot of that's blood, because he got attacked with brass knuckles and things like that. But it was ketchup. Annie had sugar poured all down her hair. She was one of the African-American students, to where she looked about like a skunk. And they were pouring it on me. And I find it noteworthy. This was probably the most integrated of all the sit-ins. There was Annie, who's black, me, who's white, and John Salter, who's Native American. So way to go.
Yeah. Well, I interrupted you about the photographer. Explain that.
He was the second-string photographer for the evening paper. First-string guy gone off to get his film developed back in the day when we had film. And Fred had graduated from the same high school as those students were from. He was only 22, just like the demonstrators. And he knew a lot of those guys. One of them lived three doors down the street from him. And he hung with their older brothers, probably dated their older sister. So, of course, when he came in, his sympathies were with his friends. He ended up standing on the lunch counter with permission from the manager, taking pictures of us and the other group that we couldn't even see for 3 hours, a picture sort of looking down at us, focused on the back of my head. And after 3 hours, his sympathies, watching his friends and watching the nonviolent demonstrators, his sympathies had shifted to the nonviolent demonstrators. And to me, that's the power of Gandhi and nonviolence. That evening, the pictures appeared in an evening paper, and a kid at a rival white high school had a change of heart, too. And to me, that's the power of the press. So I always want to honor the press. If they are combat photographers, they're in the line of fire just as much as the demonstrators. The demonstrators take it to the streets or the lunch counter. The lawyers take it to the court. But the press takes your story to the world.
I want to ask you about one of the moments that you've called probably the saddest day of the civil rights movement.
Oh, and it was.
September 1963. This is the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama, was bombed.
It was bombed just less than 3 weeks after that wonderful march on Washington, and four girls were killed. The sermon or the theme of the day was the love that forgives. And the Klan planted a bomb under the stairs of the church, and it blew up and killed four girls who were getting ready for the Sunday school program. So a week or so later was the funeral at another church. And some of us went over from my college, and the streets around the church were packed with mourners. Only people associated with the 16th Street Baptist Church and all and family could get into the church where the service was. And Dr. King preached. They had loudspeakers so we could hear him outside. They also had, the Alabama National Guard on the roofs of surrounding buildings with their rifles pointed down at us. And because, you know, we might riot. But we started to follow the cortege out to the cemetery, but turned back because they could shoot us. There would be no protection along the route. And it was a hot day in Alabama. And that was so sad. Everybody, I think, was in tears outside.
You know, there's this you've told the story about how you and some others collected some of the pieces of shattered glass from the streets.
Yes. When we came over, first, at least the van I was in, stopped at the 16th Street Baptist Church and were picking up shards of glass that were still out there in the gutter and a shotgun shell casing. And I kept a piece of that glass in my wallet for years, my change purse, to help me remember. And now I've taken out pieces for all of my grandkids, but the rest of it I have given to the New African American Museum in D.C., and they have combined it with sort of a rosette that a minister picked up on the day of the bombing, and it's all displayed as one. Shards of glass hanging in the rosette there. But
you used that as a kind of a talisman. You had it with you for years. A reminder, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Because we knew that at any moment, any of us in the movement could be killed. But those girls, they weren't demonstrating. They were getting ready for the youth program that day.
Joan Trumpauer Mulholland, she's in Utah this week. Tomorrow night, the University of Utah's College of Social Work, she's going to be hosting a screening of a documentary film about her life and activism. It's going to be followed by a conversation between Joan and her son, the filmmaker Loki Mulholland. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back for some final thoughts in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the civil rights activist and pioneer Joan Trumpauer Mulholland. She's in Utah this week. There are a few events that she's participating in. We'll give you some details about that just here at the end of the program. Do you think, Joan, there was ever a moment when, like after something like the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing, when you just thought it's too much? I can't do this. This is too violent. It's too crazy. I don't know what to do. Nothing seems to be changing.
If nothing else, it energizes you to move forward. And the people you were with had become like family. I can still see people today that I knew back then, like John Lewis and Julian Bond until he passed. And it's like yesterday. Hugs, catching up. Like nothing had happened in between. But you were family, and you can't let your family down.
Right.
You know, we were in it together. You aren't going to turn chicken or traitor on your best buddies.
Yeah. I want to ask you about May of 1964. This is, so as you've described it, the the Freedom Summer is looming. The Freedom Summer is coming in June. That's when it's going to be this great moment of activism and transition. But just on the verge of that in May, you went to Mississippi.
Well, I was in Mississippi.
You were in Mississippi, of course.
And there was a mass meeting, a big meeting being called voter registration stuff in a church in Canton, Mississippi, which was a really rough town where white civil rights workers did not go. But we decided to take a car, and everybody in it was going to be white, and go to the mass meeting. And after we left, we were followed. We got in that little stretch of no man's land between the old road and the new interstate. We were boxed in. Car had been waiting, another one following us, got boxed in. Guys came back with crowbars and started beating on the car. Got a hold of the driver. I think he may have cracked the window down to ask him what they wanted. And the driver was Hamid Kisselbash from Pakistan. Like the day or two before, the leader of the opposition party in the Indian legislature in India had been arrested in Jackson. He'd gone to a restaurant, you know, in support of the local black folks, and taken to jail. The embassy back in D.C. just went ballistic, called the State Department, called the powers that be in Mississippi, and they were to leave the Indians alone. This apparently was all on TV and national news, from what I understand. Well, Hamid was not from India. He was from Pakistan.
I didn't like people saying he was from India either, I think.
No. But we kept insisting, he's from India. Don't hit him. He's from India. And they let us go, which suggests strongly that there were people in the power structure and the law enforcement and all that in the crowd that were attacking us. And we understand since then this was to stop Freedom Summer.
Yeah. But what was the idea, do you think? The idea was to kill you.
Oh, they were going to kill us. Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Why else would they stop us and start beating on us? Now, those of us in the back seat, all the women were in the back, did not get attacked. But Hamid sure did.
Do you think you were going to die?
Oh, it did seem pretty likely that we were going to die.
And so how are you thinking about it? Do you think this is it?
Well, yeah, this is it, but you never know when you're going to go. So, hey.
You weren't shaking. Your
we
heart
were
wasn't
not,
thundering.
We talked, those of us who were in the car later, and we all knew we were going to die that night. And we were all perfectly calm. It was time for us to go. But they didn't kill us. And because they didn't kill us, they killed three other guys 2 weeks later. And two of the guys they killed were friends of us, everybody in the car, because they'd always be out on campus. Mickey Schwerner and Cheney were our friends.
Yeah.
So gotta always do a little something extra for them. So I'm talking to you.
I know you've gotten this question about that 3 weeks later, these three, you know, voter registration civil rights activists were killed. You've been asked the question, do you feel some kind of survivor guilt about that? And you said you don't feel that kind of...
No.
Guilt isn't the word that you feel.
I don't feel guilty. I just feel that those of us who came through the movement okay, psychologically and physically, have to do a little extra for those who didn't make it. So that's what I'm doing these days.
Yeah. So you don't feel like that was actually one of the questions I was thinking about, is at what point you thought, okay, my service is over.
My service isn't over. I'm talking to you right now.
Yeah.
And what I think also is important, and it probably isn't on your list of questions, is the effect. It continues. In Australia, a grad student in California from Australia went home and took the idea of the Freedom Rides with him And they had freedom rides in Australia for the Aboriginal folks. I was at their 50th anniversary. And just literally a year ago tomorrow, Valentine's Day, I was at a elementary school in a poorer section of Cape Town, South Africa. I was with a group of women who were traveling, and we were doing a day of public service. I was in a fifth-grade classroom. We combined two or three fifth grades together. And after we'd finished what we had to say and answered their questions, it wasn't civil rights-oriented. It was just, here we are, Americans. I said, now, back in the day of our civil rights movement, we had a song, We Shall Overcome. And before I could say the rest of what I was going to say, I was going to say, I want you to remember those three words, we shall overcome, because whatever adversity you're facing in life, tell yourself that, and it'll make it better. One of the fifth grade teachers, a portly gentleman of a certain age, cut right in, oh, back in our apartheid demonstrations in the 80s, we used to sing that song. Class, let's all sing it. And here I am in Cape Town, South Africa, on Valentine's Day, with all these fifth graders singing We Shall Overcome. You know, it's moving forward. And what we need to do now is move things further forward with whatever problems we're seeing.
That's Joan Trumpauer Mulholland. She's in Utah this week. Tomorrow evening, the University of Utah's College of Social Work is hosting a screening of a documentary film about her life. It's going to be followed by a conversation between Joan and her son, Loki, the filmmaker. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Joan, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
It was really a pleasure.
Mine too.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program is directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We'll be right back.